From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 304 with guest Dana Epp, recorded Monday, February 4th, 2013. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Today's guest is a repeat visitor, Dana Epp, although it's been a year, and Dana is the CEO and Chief Software Security Architect at Scorpion Software, where he leads his team to solve the obvious problems with passwords that others ignore. He has spent the last 20 years focusing on software security, has been awarded the recognition and designation by Microsoft as an Enterprise Security MVP for the last 8 years. His latest research has been on strong authentication and identity assurance, designed for practical use in small business. When he isn't working or touring around the world and speaking about information security, you can find him having fun producing web-based TV shows like CrackTheCred.TV. Welcome back, sir.
Welcome. Thank you so much. How's it going?
Things are good. Tell me about Crack the Cred TV.
Crack the Cred TV. So I think you've probably seen a couple episodes, but we had so many people asking, how is it that we can get into passwords and how do we go through the, ultimately at the end of the day, how to get around them.
Yep.
And I was tired of, especially when we're at conferences, right, when I'd be demonstrating how to, get into an Android phone or get into a Windows server, people are always spending a lot of time asking me about that. So I decided, why not kind of record some of the stuff and make it more more useful.
Sure.
Not to be an attacker, not really to demonstrate how to always attack the systems, but more importantly, to then show the countermeasures. What can you do to prevent that, or at least make it more auditable? So we show everything from, I think in one episode we talk about how to break into an HP server to get into the ILO password. It's not really breaking in. It's if you have hardware access, you can, modify the jumpers and get in and bypass the security. And,
sure.
How to get into a domain controller when you don't actually have the domain credentials, and how to crack Windows passwords using password crackers. All that kind of stuff that you need to know about. And then the countermeasures, right? When is it appropriate to use BitLocker? A lot of people don't believe me when I say you should BitLocker your domain controllers. And it's you should, because if someone can just walk up and do this attack, they're into your domain controller and then they own it. So, there are things you can do at the physical level. And that kind of stuff's what Crack Cred's all about. And we've been a little slow lately. I was trying to do one a month, but I got kind of busy on a bunch of stuff. And right now I'm getting banged a lot to start showing a little more deeper stuff, doing the pass the hashes and, how can you infiltrate, an Android phone and get, people don't realize in many cases, you got phones that these days are supposed to have the capability of connecting to so many resources, and they don't have the same strength of capability when it comes to, encryption and security. And that it's your Windows credential for your Exchange Active Sync is in clear text on
yep.
an Android phone.
Yeah.
If you know that and you know where that is, you can find some interesting things like the NFC attack. I was demonstrating at a hacker conference I was at about how there was a bug in one of the Samsung devices that was running Android. They had an NFC default connector. So you could walk right up to it and basically drop an app and sideload. Which was a manufacturer's capability. Well, you can sideload an app that would just simply go grab the clear text password and then fire that off to an IRC channel. So you can basically collect the Windows credentials. And once you got the ActiveSync capabilities, chances are that's going to be also the login to their RD gateway. And
sure.
Get them in.
Now you'll get them through everything.
Right, and so that's what Crack the Cred's about. It's just to show that kind of stuff in a interesting way. Usually we try to keep them under 10 minutes when possible, so it's a consumable.
We did a show a little while back with Rob Gillen talking about the weaknesses in the Wi-Fi infrastructure, and he built a little Raspberry Pi gizmo he carries with him
yeah.
that'll bump all the machines in a Starbucks off the network and then use rainbow tables to fake their security to their home network, and they'll just log into them.
Yep. Yep. There's actually, you can actually go out, a friend of mine runs a store called the Hack 5 Shop, and you can get something called the Pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically this It's a Linux-based device that acts and provides man-in-the-middle and runs something called Yazuga. That basically is the capability to intercept wireless signals and actually tell you and say, when you're, you know, you think about it from a Wi-Fi perspective. You walk into a Starbucks and you say, you open up your laptop and the first thing it's doing is trying to negotiate, right? It's looking for that SSID and it's all sudden, hey, I'm looking for Linksys. No, no, it's not here. I'm looking for a Starbucks. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, cool. Now automatically connect. Well, what this does is it automatically intercepts it whenever, it doesn't matter what you say. If you say, hey, I'm looking for, you know, Richard's home, and it'll say, yeah, that's me, and then it automatically connects you, and then you're not even paying attention because you're now automatically joined it, and you don't even realize that it's not the access point you think it is. So now if you're using something that's redirecting that over your own personal 3G, you're now man in the middle. Yep. So now you can do some interesting things. Like I wrote an update to the SSL strip command in Linux that actually can do a special little bit of rerouting and basically re-authing, so it's called a de-auth attack. So someone, I walk into a Starbucks when someone's there, I run a de-auth, it makes everyone drops, comes back in, they land onto this thing, and then it sends a 301 redirect, which then makes it go from an HTTPS connection to an HTTP connection just long enough for the login, and then redirects them back. So what happens? You scrape the passwords, and then the game's over. So these tools are, you know, $100, $150, and they have capability of really causing a lot of turmoil if you're not aware of what's going on there. And that's the fun part when you think about authentication is just how, in many cases, how weak it is. That's, you know, that's what my day job's all about, is finding ways to strengthen that stuff.
Well, the fact that they've, and it's the default behavior of the laptops and the phones, that as soon as they come into that network, they are calling out for what they want to connect to. So you don't even have to have taken your phone out of your pocket, and it's already been fooled through this man-in-the-middle attack and, you know, and sent every email password you've got, every your Facebook account, your Foursquare account, your Twitter account, like all those creds have already been sent.
That's right. Well, one of the coolest attacks I saw was it was based off of a Galaxy tablet. And what the attack was if you were on like Facebook or anything that was any kind of site that actually had an internal game, either Flash-based or whatever, and it was trying to connect and communicate, and it had the capability of basically doing a session injection where it could then drop new code. Now, you think about the world of Java today and how, in many cases, there's, you know, several versions that aren't as strong as they could be, and I think that's a polite way of saying it. In the end, what ends up happening is you can drop some more hostile code on there, and the user doesn't even know because it's still in their bag. They haven't even pulled it out, but because they were there previously, it's reassociating because it found it,
right.
And they're not thinking about it. It's like one of my first things I always say is never auto-associate. Force that you make the decision when and where.
When
in many cases... Exactly. And I deal with Bluetooth, too. Like, a couple of years ago, I did when I was at an SMB IT Pro conference, there was some gentlemen that were talking, and they were being a little arrogant about how good they were in the world of security and everything they were doing, and how they would never, you know, ever expose themselves. And the one guy doing it was talking while he had a Bluetooth headset in. And he made some snide remark about how that stuff's not even possible these days. And I happen to have my attack platform there because I was doing a presentation on stuff. And so one of the cool things is that there are tools out there that give you the capability of mimicking a laptop to act as a phone, and then you could do a default pairing. And since most headsets use the default pairing codes, I was able to actually pair up to his Bluetooth headset, record what he was saying, and then send it back to his headset. And it freaked him out because he was like, whoa! And I'm like, this is why you don't auto enable Bluetooth and you don't do default pairing codes, right? These guys don't realize that in many cases it's that easy to do it. If you have the right tools and you know what you're doing, it's possible. And you think about that for a second. Other than a single beep, you basically turn a Bluetooth headset, which, you know, everyone likes to Borg out at IT conferences.
Sure.
If you're not careful, you know, it can be intercepted. Now all of a sudden across the room, we're listening to your conversation.
Yeah.
And worse yet, we're recording it. So, you know, that it's, I'm happy I'm on the good side of worlds. So.
Well, and also there was guys who were building shotgun Bluetooth antennas, and they were getting 200-yard ranges out of it, too.
Oh, yeah.
So you
don't
even have to be that close to the guy, and you're able to pick them off.
That's right, yeah. And so you think about that. That's just on the side of the capability of turning it into an open mic and giving the ability to record it.
Yeah.
Now think about the guys that are doing that on the phones as well. They're enabling default pairing. They're using the phones. And that's why you should never auto-enable your Bluetooth. And when possible, turn it off. You do the same thing with the Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. It should not be auto-enabled. Turn it on when you need to and then turn it off. In many cases, the way I always do it is I throw everything into airplane mode until I need it. If I need to worry about a call coming in, I'll keep everything into cell mode and disable roaming, disable everything else I need to till I need it. In many cases, you don't have to be watching and be shackled to your phone, especially at conferences. That's the worst time, especially when you're at a hacking conference or some kind of security conference. That's usually the
turn everything off. Heck, yeah. Don't bring your phone.
I take a dumb phone. I'll usually either take a dumb phone or I'll take a throwaway phone with the expectation it will be compromised. It's just safer. But that's just me.
It's just the world that you're in at that point. It's so steeped in all that.
Yeah, pretty much.
And changing the access codes on your Bluetooth, it's just not that hard.
It's not. Well, you know what it is that a lot of times people purchase the less expensive ones, and they don't actually have interfaces to easily change the pairing on the headset. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that, but that's why, you know, pay the extra $10 and get one you can. If you can't change the default pairing code, then that's not really a safe device to use.
Yeah, just not that difficult to be a little better at it. I just found it really interesting. The conversation we had before, where because so many passwords are out in the wild now, what they say, 14 million passwords out in the wild, we're starting to build all of these rainbow tables to execute on these most common passwords. If you're in that pool, you're incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you think about it, like what Friday, Twitter had lost 250,000 accounts with their hashes, right? You run that through a set of tables. It's funny because I actually had the guys over at Offcracked had sent me an eSATA drive. It was a 3.5 gig drive with all the rainbow tables for all Windows, LM hash, and NT hash up to 8 characters, upper, lower, and special characters, going into 9 characters now.
Wow!
So you know when you're sitting there, I have almost 4 terabytes of rainbow tables now, and I've been trying to bug the guys over in the Azure team to let me just build a I just want to try it just once. I just want to scale up like 1,000 nodes and just do some cracking. The problem is the cost to put that much terabytes of data in the cloud just to build and run the rainbow tables. I couldn't do that. So I thought, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll host the SQL server here, use Azure Virtual Networks, connect it back through the back end, have a 100 or 1,000 VM nodes in the front end, and let it run through and do cracking to continue the tables, and then of course doing lookups. So then you can basically go to a web page, enter in a hash, and you can return back what's in the rainbow tables very quickly.
Right.
But the reality is, we don't need to do that. Google's already got the capability. You can take a pretty standardized MD5 hash these days, mm-hmm. and you put it in Google, and it'll return back what's there. Try it out. It works. So it's like the fastest cracker you can have, Google search.
Google search. Yeah, that's where we are. Because people have just published this stuff. It's all indexed now, and so it's just going to come up right away. I'm also very frustrated with the password mechanisms that are out there. Even Microsoft limit, upper lowercase punctuation characters and so forth, but limited to 8 characters. You're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it drives me nuts. Actually, it's funny. Office 365, as an example, has a maximum character length of 16 characters.
16.
So if you're using any kind of a password manager that is, extremely strong, it actually, standard password policies won't succeed. So, like, we have tools like the Authenticity Password Server that has the capability of generating up to, you could set up a password policy to say, I want a 64-character alphanumeric, uppercase, lowercase, special characters, and I want to auto-insert that into and utilize that in, a web page like Office 365.
Right.
That will fail. And that sucks. And it's like, but they're trying to balance usability and security that is reasonable. Most users aren't using stronger password management solutions, so it's something they're going to have to remember. And even if you're using a passphrase or a sentence to be your login, mm-hmm. Chances of it being up to 16 characters isn't actually practical for majority of the users out there. And so they're just trying to balance and understand that. I may not agree with it, but I think it's the right thing for the majority of the normal users that are out there. So,
and what is your favorite password manager these days? What are you using?
I use Authenticity Password Server. So,
you're biased.
I'm biased, yeah. So I will say there are some out there that have worked really, really well, because the one feature that the password server doesn't have today that other tools have out there is like the autofill form. And I actually used to like Descartes' skipper tool, because that was kind of cool, because it also allowed you to provision identity. But that went through the wayside.
Yeah.
There are tools out there like LastPass that work really well, but mm-hmm. I would never, ever use those type of tools unless I use strong authentication with it.
Right.
Just because I think it's ludicrous to think that we'll use a password manager and store, you know, 50 or 100 passwords in there, and then we'll just protect it with another password.
Right.
You know, it's you've got to use stronger authentication. So in those kind of systems, they support things like YubiKeys and so is the password server. So in the end, you pick what makes the most sense for you. I'm all about wanting to make sure that you control the data, though. So that's one of the reasons I would not, personally, I wouldn't use something like LastPass, because I don't have control of the data set. I have no way of actually auditing if it's ever been touched or reviewed or audited.
Right.
And so that's just me.
But I think you want to be able to carry your passwords with you, something that fits in a USB key so that, you know,
take wherever you want. Yes and no. I haven't been to a place yet where I haven't had internet access when I needed a password.
Right.
In many cases, wherever I need to have it, obviously we have Authentable Two-Factor Auth, which is a two-factor authentication solution.
Mm-hmm.
So when possible, we actually don't use a password at all. We use the two-factor auth, so my phone generates the password for me, so I don't need to remember anything.
Right.
So that's where we use it where we can. And then we have Authentable Single Sign-On, which allows us, it uses the Security Search and Markup Language, or SAML, to do single sign-on to pretty much everything. So when we log in Office 365, as an example, our account, we don't have passwords at Office 365. We actually use single sign-on, and so we actually use an Authentable credential, because what we do with single sign-on is if you're not already signed in for the day, on your website, on the web portal, it will prompt you for an Authentable two-factor auth cred, and then it redirects you back into Office 365, into Intune, into Microsoft Dynamics, anything you want to use that uses Microsoft Online Services. It will actually automatically let you in. So you need no passwords, which is by far the best way. If you can do it securely and have two-factor auth in there, having to not need to know a password is a way better way to go about it. When there's places that don't support that and don't support SAML and don't support two-factor auth, then what we do is I store that stuff in the password server, which has got a web interface that you can run on your mobile or run on a browser, and you can extract and get that credential when you need it. So that works for me. And what's better is it's better audited. The concept of having passwords on a USB stick, which could get lost, means that you have no capability of knowing if someone else retrieves it and then utilizes it.
Right.
And so it's actually kind of interesting is the guys over at Elcomsoft, which do a lot of password cracking tools, they actually did a really good white paper talking about all the smartphone apps out there. They reviewed something like, I think it was between 10 and 15 of the most popular smartphone apps in the App Store.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to determine that almost all of them were breachable, because if you break the master password or the PIN lock that they use to get into the app, now you're into all the local passwords, and you have no auditing. You don't know that someone's looked at that password. That's one of those things that the Authentable Password Server does, is that every interaction is audited.
Right.
So you can say, hey, Dana looked at this password while he was at home. Hey, Dana looked at this password from his phone while he was at a Starbucks. So that there's some better audit controls. And then, of course, because you have that, you have the capabilities of being able to do revocation real quickly, because you can actually go in there and say, hey, run a report. What passwords has Dana's ever seen? And it gives you a list, and there's a button there that says expire these. And so any password that's in a sync state or something that can be automatically rotated, like a Windows password or service account or a scheduled task, those automatically get changed. And then those that can't, it puts you in your dashboard and say, go change these at these websites, because, you got to go do that.
Something weird has happened. I've noticed in general that Google and Facebook, a few other sites now, as a guy who travels to weird and wonderful places, as I was in China and I logged in, right away, Google's yelling at me and Facebook's yelling at me, hey, are you in China? Because you just logged in over here.
Geographical profiling. It's awesome because it gives you this capability to say, hey, I'm trying to log in. I'm normally, like you think of yourself, you're in the Vancouver region, so when it sees it coming from the common computers, not a big issue. But if all of a sudden you're in a new geography that you've never been to, it can question that and say, is that real? And that's what's called risk-based authentication decisions.
Sure.
I got to say, Facebook's actually done a pretty good job. They actually have this new capability. Most people don't know it. If you have a Facebook app and you scroll down to the bottom under this menu, there's an option there for a code generator. And if you turn that feature on, and it's not on by default, what it does is anytime you connect from an unknown device, it will send to your phone, or it'll allow you to generate it. If you're like on an iOS, it actually generates code for you.
Mm-hmm.
It will prompt you and say, you must first enter in this code. So it provides a multi-factor authentication check, because it's saying, do you actually have the device that we already know that you own to register or validate that this other device? So if you're in China, I don't know about you, but when I go to foreign countries that I may or may not have complete trust in, I typically don't take devices of trust.
Right.
Just because I'm just going to assume that they'll be looked at or confiscated or accessed.
Mm-hmm.
But I would look at something like the capability of being able to be notified, hey, you're now in this new region. Do you wish to approve that? Well, then I would make that available. Mm-hmm. A text message would be a good way of doing that. A little expensive in China probably for something like that, but you know, at the end, it would give me the code to say, yeah, that's me, and that is authorized. And then that gives you a level of assurance that you are who you say you are.
Yeah, a little more certainty around all those things behave. I think it's a feel-good thing, too, when you see that a site like Facebook has noticed you're doing something different. You know, I remember Facebook hasn't done, I haven't seen this in a while. Maybe I'm just not spending much time on Facebook anymore. But when it would start throwing up pictures of people and saying, hey, do you know who this is? Do you know who this is? Because
it's very interesting. I was just at a security conference. And what was funny is they were telling us about it. The privacy security guys at Facebook were talking about it. And this was actually a Blue Hat in December. Mm-hmm. And I can't really talk too much about it because it's obviously private. But the one part that was kind of public and they've talked about was some of the risks to that. They tried that and they were trying it on some accounts. But they started coming into some problems because what was happening is that, first off, there are actual picture search tools out there. So you could take that picture, pop it into a search engine, it would come back and tell you certain things.
Right.
Worse yet, though, is that what some people were doing to bypass it so they couldn't remember it is in the pictures they would tag it or put their names on the pictures. Or worse yet, they'd have their names on it.
Yeah.
Like you'd have someone with, you know, and so I remember this one they were demonstrating. It was like you were trying to prove to recover your account. You had to actually look at these three pictures and tell the people who they were. And on all three pictures, one of them had, it was at the guy's desk. So it had his name right on his placard on his desk. The other person had, they were at a conference and they had a little, their name badge.
Right.
You know, and it had their name right there. And the third one was a well-known picture of an actress. And so all of a sudden, it was like what the system was supposed to be about identity and assuring, hey, these are your friends, all of a sudden became a point of weakness because, well, the answer was right in the picture.
Right.
And they couldn't tell that.
You go from it being a recovery mechanism to it being an exploit mechanism.
Yeah, exactly, because now it's like, you know, you're saying, well, who are these three people? And it's like, oh, okay, that's a picture of, you know, Jennifer Aniston or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, and then who knows? So it was an interesting scenario that I never thought of. It's like, here we're trying to do social authentication.
Yeah, great idea.
Great idea, but the execution falls flat just because you can't account for how people would use that,
right?
If they meant to or not. They were demonstrating somewhere people were wanted to get to this pretty reasonably. So what they were doing was, because one of the capabilities would be Buddy could actually know someone else, know all of his friends. He would reset the account because he would know everybody on the pictures.
Right.
So like at one point they were doing tagging. So it's like you would know, just tell me who that person is based off of the tags that were in the Facebook pictures. Well, if you're a buddy of theirs, chances are you have the same circle of influence. You know those people.
Sure.
So now what that was meaning is it was allowing friends to hijack other people's accounts.
Or, you know, ex-significant others, people with grudges.
Yeah. And that becomes a problem. And that was the issue they were having, was that these guys would take over the accounts and then do silly and funny things on Facebook. And now Facebook's at this level of liability because they got in, but Facebook's tried putting good security in. They're doing, you know, they're trying to be good netizens.
Yeah.
And it's being abused.
Yeah.
And so I that's the kind of challenging stuff that's pretty fun, because at the end of the day, you're really thinking about it and going, wow, I would have never thought of that as an attack vector.
Well, I think 2012 was a really big year for exploiting recovery mechanisms to hijack identities.
Oh, yeah. Well, you take a look at Matt over at Wired, right?
Yeah.
Like he got nailed big time. And it all started because it was able to intercept and get access to a couple of his accounts. Next thing you know, his phone was wiped and his iPad was wiped and his laptop was wiped and recovering it. And there's a great article on Wired. If the audience hasn't had a chance to go read about his experiences, it was very interesting. And I actually got to meet him during Blue Hat and we talked a little bit about it. And it's because he's not a techie. Like he's, you know, obviously he's a writer and he's got that, but he's not in the world of the deep tech. And
sure,
in the end, he got nailed pretty hard. And there's a lot of us that, you know, live in a world where all of our devices end up getting shackled to like one password.
Mm-hmm.
You think about that. It scares me sometimes. I love the concept of social authentication, like using your Facebook account to log into all these other resources. But if that gets breached, that's a single point of failure now. Now you're accessing everything. It's one of the negatives of single sign-on by default, is that single sign-on means, hey, you get in, now you have access to everything. That is its power, but it's also its weakness. Because if you don't have a way to validate that identity, in the end, that actually becomes a crutch, which is why I always suggest multi-factor two-factor authentication or device authentication where you have a little more control. You have something and you know something, and those two factors give you the capability of saying, I have a higher level of certainty that you are actually the intended party.
Right.
Can't be guaranteed. People with, you know, monkey wrenches and sledgehammers can do a lot to your knees and take your phone and do whatever, but the practicality of that in this day and age of the world is just not there.
Well, wasn't Matt's ultimate exploit that someone successfully socially engineered a tech support person to give away too much information?
That's right, exactly. And then it ended up being, you know, the credit card and all that stuff. Because at the time, some sites like Netflix and Amazon, they look and ask for things like, what are your last four digits of your credit card? But if you have access to one of these accounts,
sure,
you can see the last four because they're not considered sensitive.
Right.
And then so all of a sudden you ask. And this is one of the problems with social proofs. When you go to something, do a recovery process, and it's like, okay, you answer these three questions. First one, where were you born? Okay, we can't find that on Facebook? Come on, give me a break.
Yeah.
Where did you go to school? Okay, quick Google would pretty much find that, or on your LinkedIn profile. And then it's, you know, maybe something is, and, you know, what's your favorite cat or something? And, well,
right,
look at that. There's Fluffy's name right on there on your Facebook profile. You don't know the person. This is called doxing, and it's something that hackers do all the time, is this capability of learning and getting as much information and background about somebody based off of basically using tools like Google and Bing to extract a lot of information that's in there. And there are tools there now these days that go even deeper. So they can go through your social influence. They look through your Twitter. They can find information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a good chance, if you're following your favorite football team, maybe that's your alma mater. And if that's the question, what's your favorite football team? You know what? That's probably you bragging about, you know, the Ravens winning. And the next thing you know, that becomes the proof on the question in your recovery at Google.
Yeah, I do appreciate that when we want to have recovery questions, it should be questions that I construct, because I could pull up questions that aren't, you know, in my Facebook profile. You know,
yeah.
Your favorite pet's a mistake. Your first pet's probably a good one, because that's from way in your past. It's normally never referenced. You'll probably remember it. You know, that's a pretty good term that isn't going to be easily discovered online.
See, what I do is that in the Authentable Password Server, you can create passwords of any kind. So I'll create a password called Recovery Question 1 Google. And in there, I'll just create a random password. So I don't care what the question is.
Right.
If the question is whatever, the answer is going to be just a random password. It doesn't matter. As long as it matches with what the question is,
mm-hmm,
you ultimately get a better way. So even if they had the question being, you know, where were you born? And the answer is, you know, question mark, exclamation, BZ, 42, whatever, right?
Right.
Some big log, god-awful random thing. It doesn't matter, as long as it matches up. So as long as you have some sort of way of managing that,
yeah,
then you're in a position where that helps. And that's what I do for all my response question answers, is I have inside the password server, you have something called a private vault where you can have your own thing that not even administrators in the vault have access to, because
mm-hmm,
the password server is a, you know, it's a business tool meant for entire organizations. I don't want administrators to have access to be able to recover that information. That's
no.
My stuff. So my private vault, I have that kind of stuff in there. And so then that gives me comfort that only I can do that recovery on there. And then I always create a printout of it every quarter, and that gets put in a sealed envelope that's at my home, at the safety deposit at our bank, that my wife has access to. You know, there's that risk, but I trust
yep.
her. So
at some point, you got to trust somebody.
Yeah, and for me, it's about succession planning. You know, if I get hit by a bus and someone needs to go in and turn off my Facebook account, I need to make that reasonably available.
Right.
And that's why I do that. And having the physical password one on there is that, you know, if my wife's distraught because, you know, I'm dead, we'll never hope that ever happens. But, you know, the reality is that she's got a mechanism without having to contact the company to get access to the password server and to do what is in there. And that's just me being socially responsible of how to deal with my identity when I'm no longer there.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing that happened in 2012 was folks telling Facebook this person's dead, whether they were or not, so that they locked them out of their own account.
Yeah.
You know, became a gravestone account.
Yeah, yeah. And what's funny is it's like, you know, they used to always joke about that when people would call in, you know, hostages or call in house invasions, and then all of a sudden you get SWAT coming to people's houses.
Right.
Now they're doing the same thing on the internet. It's like, hey, this person's dead. Oh my gosh, you know, can you please take care of it? And then all of a sudden they're locked out, and then that person's sitting there. And if you, again, we're back to, if you're then using your Facebook account to log into everything online,
right?
Now you're toast.
Yeah, you are toast.
Recoveries are, no, sir, you're dead, or that person is dead.
Yeah.
So who are you? You're just trying to social engineer us. You're having to prove who you are.
Yeah. Yeah, socially engineered for social engineering. I love that.
Yeah.
So what's next for you, my friend? We ranted on about security for a half an hour. What are you working on?
What am I working on these days? Mm-hmm. We're just trying to find better ways to make it so you don't need passwords. That's right. My day job. I do that all the time. Even with my MVP stuff, we're going around trying to teach people. In the SMB, the world of moving to the cloud is becoming more and more predominant. And it's fraught with danger because now all of a sudden, hey, let's move from using small business server on-premise and moving to going to Office 365 in the cloud. Yep. And now all of a sudden you're going to use a credential and exposing it. Now you're either going to be remembering a second credential, or you're going to do something like, maybe you're going to federate your Windows credential, which is not always the greatest idea. Or if you can't afford or build that out, you're going to try to sync it up in some kind of weird way. And then we're back to the big problem, which is 61% of all people use the same password on multiple websites. Yep. Now all of a sudden, your business website or your business password becomes your personal password, and someone breaches the personal site and now gets access to your Office 365 account or your CRM data or whatever it is. And so we're trying to find and build better ways to deliver a solution that will make that work. So in the day job, I'm trying to find out how to make that commercially viable. In my night job, I'm trying to find newer ways that aren't commercially viable yet, but we're at least going down that direction to understand identity better and understand why passwords suck so much and what we can do to make them a little more reasonably usable. It's a sad reality. And that's one of those reasons I like doing like Crack the Cred, is it allows people to see without being threatening and without I don't like talking to people and trying to scare them, because this, a lot of this stuff can be addressed by just using common sense and matching it up with just a little bit of diligence. Mm-hmm. But the reality is sometimes you just got to show it and say, people don't go, I'm going to this phone because it's just a better phone, I have control. I'm like, yeah, okay, so you're going to root your iPhone. That's a really good idea. Watch this. And then all of a sudden, people are like, oh, okay, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. Like, no, it's just you got to, security is about risk mitigation, not risk avoidance. Yeah. With enough money and motive, anything can be breached. So the reality is you're just trying to find a balance that says these people will move on to an easier target and leave you alone.
It's like putting a club on your steering wheel. It doesn't make your car impossible to steal. It makes it more awkward than the other car.
That's right. But, someone that's got a plasma torch or has got a hacksaw can just as easily cut the steering wheel. Yeah. And screw. That's one thing I always loved when the club first came out. That's a perfect example. It's like it gives you the perception of security. Yep. So you get those guys that are like, oh, man, I'll move on to something easier. They don't even worry about it. Then you get the guys that are going to go, oh, I'm going to try and use a hacksaw and break into the club. And I'm like, why? It's the steering wheel's rubber. Just cut the steering wheel, and then you pull the thing off. And that's what, the criminals do, or did, and things have got harder now because the steering wheels have far more steel and make it more difficult. But
if for crimes of opportunity, you just take the less difficult car. If somebody really wants you, they'll get you.
That's right. And then the question is, how do you respond to that? And that's one of those things I think that a lot of people don't consider and think about. It's like it's that aspect, like printing out those passwords, right? In the worst case scenario, if everything was to fail, they breached all my systems, and that it would not be fun. Mm-hmm. But the reality is I could recover. I've got an idea. I know where everything is. Yep, there would still be some difficulties. Things like I think one of the ones that I see all the time that when I'm talking with customers that kind of drives me nuts is there are certain sites like LinkedIn. They're not a site of identity proof, but people use them all the time. Sure. They're like, hey, well, I see that you're a member of that company, so I must be able to trust you. The thing is, you can become an employee of any company. I could become an employee of your company by simply just saying I am.
Yep.
Right? And because you and I are already friends, there would be a level of trust that would say, wow, hey, he's a friend of Richard's and he works over there. So you know what? He must be the security guy over at Strangeloop, so I will tell him everything he wants to know. That can happen. By the way, that did happen to us.
Really?
That happened to us in, I think it was November, December. We actually had some guy in Vancouver who was representing himself as one of our head sales guys, and he was walking around Vancouver and saying he was.
Wow.
I never met the guy, didn't know anything about him. We contacted LinkedIn. It took us almost a month to get him removed off of our site as saying that he's an employee.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it just that kind of stuff happens. So then the question gets into is, well, how do you deal with that? When that kind of security incident, first off, how do you even know about it? How do you look for that kind of stuff? When is it important to realize that sometimes you just got to look closely? I ended up writing a blog post about it and basically just telling people, it's like, hey, if you want to know if someone is actually an employee of the company, see if they're actually a first-level friend of mine and are on the company site. If they're not, then consider it suspect.
Yeah, no kidding. Why would anybody... That's part of ScorpionSoft, not be a friend of yours on LinkedIn. That's crazy.
Yeah, you would think.
But people have to look. Why are they, you know, they've got to have that suspicious mind in the first place.
But if all they're doing is just typing in, you know, Dana App, and oh, he works at StrangeLoop. Oh, he's friends with Richard Cat. That Richard guy, I remember him. He's like, okay, so that he must be. You know, that's not enough. You got to look deeper.
That's funny. Hey, Dana, half hour's flown by as usual.
Sad, sad, sad. But I love it, you know, and, you know, feel free and call me anytime and we'll talk about pretty much anything.
You bet. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.